Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You are listening to It's All About Food. And thanks so much for joining me today. I'm really looking forward to this program for so many reasons. So let's just get right to it. As many of you know, I have been a vegan for about 31 years and a vegetarian for much longer. And I've been on this journey for a long time, doing my own activism and learning from so many others. But there's one person in particular that I continue to go to for inspiration and information and enlightenment, and we're going to be hearing from her today. Karen Davis has a new book out called For the Birds, From Exploitation to Liberation. Karen Davis, PhD, is the president and founder of United Poultry Concerns, a nonprofit organization that promotes the compassionate and respectful treatment of domestic fowl, including a sanctuary for chickens in Virginia, inducted into the National Animal Rights Hall of Fame for outstanding contributions to animal liberation. She is the author of Prisoned Chickens, Poisoned Eggs, An Inside Look at the Modern Poultry Industry, More Than a Meal, The Turkey in History, Myth, Ritual, and Reality, The Holocaust and the Handmaid's Tale, A Case for Comparing Atrocities, a children's book, A Home for Henny, and Instead of Chicken, Instead of Turkey, A Poultryless Poultry Potpourri, a vegan cookbook. And now we're going to be talking about For the Birds. Dr. Karen Davis, thank you.
Hey, Karen.
Hey, Karen. Awesome first name. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing great as well, a little overworked as usual. And
yeah.
I wanted to say I'm very sorry I missed you the last time you were in New York. I really enjoy opportunities to relax and enjoy delicious vegan food with you. It's always a lot of fun.
Well, we will definitely have a new opportunity coming up, so I will be glad to see you then, I hope.
Yes. Now, I want to tell you, I just finished about an hour ago reading For the Birds. I've read three books in like 5 days, and all of them have been very different and powerful in different ways, giving so many reasons why we shouldn't be exploiting non-human animals on this planet. And I can't help but be reminded that we're living in this like B-grade sci-fi movie, but it's reality. And we don't want to watch the film. But you have written some very compelling chapters. Some of them are more difficult to read than others because of the truth that they expose. Some of them are filled with joyful stories, and I want to touch on a lot of them. Okay, so let's first talk about how did this book get its conception? What started the reason behind For the Birds?
Well, Karen, you know, I've written a number of essays over the years, that is more extended scholarly essays, as well as many shorter pieces. And some of them have been published in anthologies by, you know, academic anthologies and elsewhere. And I wanted to put together in a single volume those essays that I feel are most important to be available as a book, in a book, and as a single volume. So it was very difficult because I've been writing for over 30 years about chickens and turkeys and the poultry industry and developing conceptual analyses of different aspects of these birds' experience, both in our sanctuary environment and how they are treated when they are in an industrial environment where they are stripped of everything that means anything to them in terms of happiness and expressiveness and joy and happiness and cheerfulness in life. So I wanted to put together these essays that I've been writing right up through now. And so I decided last fall to take the plunge and start looking through my writings to see which ones I really wanted to put together in this book collection. And I asked Martin Rowe of Lantern Books, who has published two of my previous books, The Holocaust and The Handmaid's Tale, and my book on turkeys, More Than a Meal, The Turkey in History, Myth, Ritual, and Reality, if he would be interested in looking at a manuscript and considering publishing what became For the Birds, From Exploitation to Liberation. And Martin responded right away and said yes, he would be very interested in seeing a manuscript. And so I spent, I guess it was last December mostly, into January, doing revisions and doing all the preparations that you have to do for any article, or certainly for a book, but even when you are putting together works that in large part have been published previously in different places, different volumes and so on, you have to comb through each one with an eagle eye to make all of those edits and updates and make it all what you want it to be now. You want it to be a book that really does stand the test of time, that really does bring people, readers, into the world of the birds, whose lives I am doing my best to evoke through my daily experience since 1985 with chickens, turkeys, peafowl, and ducks here in our sanctuary, as well as my reading extensively into all of the poultry industry literature, and continuing to do that up to this very moment, way back in the late 1980s, when I had pretty much decided to start United Poultry Concerns as a national nonprofit organization. I, believe it or not, had not even used a computer, so I still wrote everything out in longhand, and I spent hours and hours reading through the poultry industry literature that I had started to familiarize myself with at the huge agriculture library in Beltsville, Maryland, outside Washington, D.C., and I just really plunged into it, and as I've told in the past, back in the late 1980s, when I ran by some leading activists in the animal rights movement, my idea for starting an organization that would focus attention on chickens and turkeys, I received two responses diametrically opposed. One was, it's a great idea, sure, wonderful, but you're never going to be able to sustain an organization that focuses on chickens and turkeys because, as one person said, we can't even get people to pay enough attention to whales, so how are we ever going to get people to pay attention to a chicken or a turkey? And the other responses were, don't wait, do it now, go for it. So basically, regardless of what anybody had thought at the time, or it said, I had already decided that I was going to start this organization. Because first of all, as the book reveals, For the Birds reveals, I have a lifelong affinity for birds generally. As far back as I can remember myself as a conscious person, as a very young child, I was always particularly drawn to the robins and the cardinals, and I believe there were blue jays in our yard in Altoona, Pennsylvania. And when a baby bird would happen to fall out of a nest in the springtime and would usually not even have any feathers yet and would be crying and crying, and the mother bird would be all upset, and I responded to that at a very visceral level. Many other issues and other animals too, particularly dogs who I grew up with. But there was just something about the birds, and as I describe in my autobiographical essay with which For the Birds Begins, a traumatic experience I had when I was maybe 10 years old, 8 or 9 or 10, was when the companion duck of a family who lived up the road from us in Altoona was hit by a car on our main road. And this was a white, what I now know to be a Pekin duck, a white duck who was just, who just lived in their yard, in their home. And as I wrote in my book, I had seen dogs be hit by cars, which was a horrific experience, needless to say. But there was something about when that duck was actually hit by a car that I will never forget it. So I just have this strong affinity for birds. And when in the 1980s I joined the animal rights movement, particularly in 1983, that was really when I joined the movement and made my pledge that I would commit myself to animals and animal rights for the rest of my life, which is exactly what I've done. But when I learned about just the immense suffering that we as a species inflict on every type of animal on the planet, in every situation we can possibly contrive to make them suffer and live miserably. But I was also learning that of all of the animals, the many countless billions of animals in this country alone, let alone worldwide, the largest number of animals were the animals in agribusiness, agriculture, the animals people eat or whose milk they drink. And of those animals, of all land animals, 98% or more are chickens. And the numbers exceeded only by the number of aquatic animals, fish and shrimp and others. And so my personal affinity for birds and my learning about the poultry industry, the horribleness of the poultry industry, plus when my husband and I rented a little house in Potomac, Maryland in the mid-1980s, it just turned out that our landlady was actually raising about 100 chickens each year in order to benefit from the agricultural tax status that having these chickens conferred upon her. Yeah, right. And she also had 4 cows, really, you know, castrated bulls, steers. Now, they had a very nice living arrangement there because there were 25 acres where these cows could range as they pleased, but, of course, they were then going to go to slaughter because that was the only reason she kept them, plus the tax break. But when on a June day when I happened to stumble upon this shed, a few yards buried in foliage, but a few yards from where my husband and I were renting this little one-story house with an unfinished basement, and I started to, there were these chickens in this little shed, and I got into the habit of visiting them every day in June of 1985. And I would sit on the dirt floor with them, and when I would approach this little shed on the dirt path through the foliage, by the second day, they would be at the door there, looking out through the screen. They just were so happy to have my company, anybody's company, but certainly they were happy to have my company because I was immediately drawn to them. And so I would take a book or a magazine in the afternoon, and I would go and I would sit on the floor, the dirt floor with them, and I just was enchanted by them. Now, these were the huge, heavy birds known by the industry as broiler chickens, the birds who represent the 98% of land animals, the ones who are bred and raised for the meat industry, the poultry meat industry. And I saw how they tended to have heart attacks, even though it was clear they were very young. They were extremely large. They had very large breasts and course, that's what these birds are bred for, mainly. It's just their breast muscle tissue, which is hanging down off their bodies like some big volleyball almost. It's so awful. But those birds were kind of a direct entry into getting to know them as individuals and experiencing the pathos of their lives and their just how nice they were and how sociable they were. And of course, reading all the time as I was doing back then into the poultry industry and animal agribusiness and so on, I began to understand what these birds represented in terms of where chickens came from originally, which is Southeast Asia and the tropical forests of Southeast Asia and the foothills of the Himalayan mountains. Chickens are pheasants. They're like all pheasants. That's where they come from, and that's where pheasants come from, the pheasants who are actually called pheasants. But chickens are pheasants, too. So I was just constantly reading. In those days, as I say, I didn't even have a computer. I was just reading industry literature. I would go to the Beltsville Library. I'd get a stack pass, and I'd go up to whatever that floor was where there were just so many volumes, all volumes of nothing but poultry farming. It's just amazing to see the huge amount of writing about farming chickens and turkeys and geese and ducks. It's all there to read and to be not, you know, be very distressed by, because the cruelties visited.
It's all there in black and white. They just make it okay by saying how
to factory farming. It didn't just start with factory farming, as a lot of people seem to think. Once you read into the history of animal farming in general and poultry farming in particular, you understand that everything that we call factory farming, industrialized animal and poultry farming, actually has roots in all of the behaviors and attitudes going back centuries. All around the world.
Absolutely. This is humanity. We have been exploiting for personal benefit, whether it's been animals or people or the planet, since the beginning of time.
Yeah, it certainly appears to be the case.
It certainly appears to be the case. Anyway, we are very glad that you discovered your affinity for birds and have taken the path that you did. I don't know how many people speak as articulately or scholarly or passionately as you do, putting it all together and fearlessly.
Well, when you stand up for somebody, especially somebody or a group of beings, whoever they may be, who have no rights and who are not understood and who are denigrated largely by whatever group you're trying to wedge your way into to change their minds, you have to be strong and fearless, because you have to stand up for those you have pledged to stand up for. So you have to speak up and speak out, and you have to be an advocate. And when I think of the work that I do, one way I think of myself is in terms of being an advocate, as in as a trial lawyer. It's where you have a defendant, and you are their advocate, and you stand up in the courtroom, and you make their case, and you do it as compellingly, as articulately, as fiercely, as evidence-based as you possibly can, because you're there vicariously representing them and their interests. So when I think of my work for chickens, turkeys, and other domesticated fowl, and by extension for animals and animal liberation, I think of myself in terms of being an advocate, as in a court of law. I'm making the case. I'm combining fact, empathy, and analysis to bring the delight and the plight and the realities of these birds into the consciousness of as many different audiences as I possibly can. And of course, I have the very good fortune of being surrounded by chickens and peafowl and ducks every single day of my life. So they're right outside my window, my office window here. I can see them and hear them. And we don't have any turkeys right now. The turkeys we have had in the past were from the turkey industry, and they suffered from the various kinds of debilitations, the overweight, the fast rapid growth, the consequential skeletal lameness that they and the chickens bred for the meat industry and also the ducks suffer from as a result of being forced to grow too big, too fast, and their bones can't support the body weight, so they almost always tend to become lame in a very short amount of time. So we've had turkeys, and getting to know turkeys in a direct and personal way here in our sanctuary actually led me to decide to write my book, More Than a Meal, The Turkey in History, Myth, Ritual, and Reality. And I have a good chapter on what I call the carnivalization of the turkey at Thanksgiving, because I became interested in how, okay, I know turkeys now. I know turkeys, at least to an extent, from my direct personal experience with them from adopting them into our sanctuary. But I was fascinated and disgusted every Thanksgiving how the news media would always represent turkeys as stupid and a lot of obscenity. Kind of, you, on the one hand, you have all this super purity, respecting the pilgrims in Plymouth Rock and all that piety. And then on the other hand, on the other side, you have all this smutty, mean-spirited, carnivalesque treatment of this symbol of Thanksgiving, the turkey. And I wanted to investigate that. I wanted to understand, well, who are turkeys? Who are they when outside of the industry or outside of a sanctuary or outside of a news media slam of these birds? And I'm telling you, and I tell everybody who's listening, that just like chickens, these turkeys are amazing. I learned so much from going back into the history of all kinds of people who, for example, came from Europe to this country, and they didn't do this country any good, I'll tell you that much. The turkeys and other animals suffered under the Native Americans, but they suffered even a worse fate under the European onslaught. Explorers and invaders and whatnot would describe their encounters with turkeys. Of course, they always had their muskets or some other weapon, you know, but they would often write very interestingly, very even caringly, it's the strangest thing, about the turkeys, like Audubon, who just, you know, murdered many, many, many millions of all kinds of birds, and that's what he based his art on. But even him describing when he came across turkeys, how friendly they were, and how what interesting birds they were. And he said, and I really thought liked them quite a lot until I shot them all. But I thought I should save one so I didn't feel like a murderer. That's exactly what he wrote. So,
well, the disconnect between what humans think and do and feel is just mind-boggling to me, because people are very aware of what they're doing, and then they do it, and somehow it's all okay.
Well, see, the thing is with turkeys are chickens are very curious, but they're also very shy around humans, coming from the tropical forests and living that kind of a life and so on. But, of course, chickens can also become extremely affectionate, and if they know they're safe with you and they're happy with you, as ours are here at our sanctuary, they become totally affectionate. But the thing about turkeys is, turkeys would walk up to just about anybody, wild turkeys, centuries, because turkeys are Native Americans. I mean, they're true Native Americans. Turkeys have not been found anywhere else in the world, but in the Western Hemisphere, on this continent, both in North America, Central America, South America. When the Europeans came to what became the Americas, there were turkeys all over the place. And by the beginning of the 20th century, the turkeys had been almost completely wiped out because they were being shot all the time by everybody, whether it was Audubon or whoever. They just were always shooting them. They held, you know, turkey shoots. They loved to, these troops and others who would be tramping through the countryside or the woods or whatever. They loved when turkeys would all be roosting in the trees at night, and they would cover about a mile. There would be all these turkeys up in the trees. And what would these men do? They would get out their muskets or whatever their weapons were, and they would just shoot them all down. And they would write, like, they thought it was hilarious how these wounded turkeys would try to get away from them. And they would try to hide. And this was carried into farming, where we still have these kinds of, like, throwing turkeys out of airplanes and throwing them with chickens and turkeys with toilet plungers off high ramps as a form of carnivalesque entertainment. So the point is, what I also learned was that turkey mothers will fight to the death, as will a chicken mother, for their young. They will fight with eagles in the sky. There is nothing cowardly about chickens or turkeys, and in fact, I have to tell people this, if you don't mind, but we have a policy here at our sanctuary where it's a no chick hatching policy. That's our policy. And except for what happened 3 weeks ago, we've adhered to that, except there were two chicks, each hatched unexpectedly in the past 30 years. There was one at one time when we were still up in Maryland, and then one here in Virginia, where we've been since 1998. But in 2014, we had 1,200 square feet completely enclosed as an outdoor aviary, which is predator-proof, but we retained all the trees, all the bushes, all the wooded areas. So we just happened to have a super excellent building contractor who actually pulled this whole beautiful outdoor predator-proof aviary together in the summer of 2014. And it's truly wonderful. And then last July, because we had this predator-proof large sanctuary situation, we agreed to take in 50 birds rescued from a cockfighting raid in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And we said, they were all supposed to be hens, but it turned out they were about 4 months old. So it turned out three are roosters and 47 are hens. Well, when spring came this year, suddenly we discovered that while we've always dealt with many eggs in the springtime with all of our rescued hens from battery cages and everywhere else, the eggs, they, you know, just really proliferate in the spring and early summer. But this year, with these young so-called game hens, they were laying so many eggs in secluded places that we didn't even realize. And all of a sudden, on a Saturday morning, as I was out in a wooded area within our sanctuary confines, and I saw one of the beige-colored hens, game hens, she was sitting there in a hollow next to one of the trees. I thought I saw an egg underneath her breast, under her body. So I went, I sort of pushed her aside to get that egg out, and things moved.
Aww.
Like, oh my God, what is this?
And
it turned out there were 6 newborn chicks.
Oh.
I know. So on the one hand, I was like, oh no. But on the other hand, I was saying, oh wow, isn't this great? So
yeah,
one died very soon afterward. I don't know why. She just simply died. But in the meantime, the other 5 appear to be thriving. And to see a mother hen so fiercely protective of her young, and there was a situation a couple of weekends ago where these little chicks, so small, would actually be able to get through the wire to the other side, outside the aviary, where they would be totally vulnerable. So we took care of that. But the thing is that the mother hen, because she could not protect them, she was so distressed, and she was yelling and everything. You couldn't, you know, you couldn't miss her voice. She was yelling with distress. And when I went over to try to help, she actually jumped up in my face, and her claws scratched my face because she was just so distressed by the fact that she could not protect her chicks because they were on the other side of the wire. And they were, of course, cheeping madly because they were distressed. But what I'm saying here is this, that chickens are, and of course, there's Brandy Alexander, the father. He reminds me of a teenage father who's not quite ready to bear responsibilities for his family, you know? He's kind of doing other things. And I keep saying to him, no, she's not your wife. Your wife is over here. But, you know, he looks at me, but he does as he pleases. But the thing is, he's very involved in being with them. Now, not all day, but he gets involved with them. He comes over and spends time with them. And, of course, they're growing larger now, and they're running around. They're all excited, cheeping all the time. But it's wonderful to see all of our chickens and the peafowl. We have five peahens, rescued peahens, and a peacock named Frankincense who's been with us since on his own since the year 2000, plus the ducks. And to see them all together, mingling and just so full of energy and vitality and interest in everything, it really gives you an understanding of what chickens and other birds are in their own world, where they are living autonomously. Now, they're not living autonomously here entirely because obviously they can't roam outside the precincts, but they have the trees, they have the bushes, they have the soil. They arrange their own social order, which is not a static pecking order type of order at all. It's a very fluid, very polyphonic, very dynamic kind of order. And all kinds of things go on. I mean, chicken hens will get into little tiffs with each other, and they'll jump at each other, and their hackle feathers, their neck hackle feathers will be up, and they'll jump over top of each other, and they have issues with each other. You know, I don't know what they are, but they have their own little spats and whatnot. But the thing is, they're all living together. They're living in an animated and congenial way, where they have their own dramas, they have their own lives. And of course, in my book, I have a whole chapter called it's all based upon my observations, my experiences with our birds, and my speculations and interpretations of their behaviors and the attitudes that they show in my presence. And when I'm looking down on them, for example, from the second floor, and I see what really is the most beautiful, like a dance, like a choreography of their movements when you look down on the yard and see their, just how beautiful they are. Oh, the chapter is chapter 9 for the birds. It's called The Mental Life of Chickens as Observed Through their Social Relationships. And this is, as I say, where I really talk about, I talk about particular birds who I came to know well, both roosters and hens. I speculate on their various behaviors, and I evoke their lives. And that's what I want to do. I want to, as much as I can possibly do, to evoke the lives of chickens and turkeys so that we're not just using routinized language about them. Well, they suffer. Well, it's cruel. Well, you know, we have to get beyond that into a more nuanced and in-depth look at their lives. And I would call it, in part, to try to get to the poetry of their experience and of one's experience just being a part of their lives, really being part of the privilege of their companionship. So, if anything, I want people to understand something of who these birds are when they're not in a condition of human-imposed abject misery. And as I've often described, and I know I talk about it in the book, baby chicks, for example, chickens are very vocal. They crow. They don't just crow and cluck, but they have many vocalizations. They have like a singing siren sound. They have trills. They have all kinds of vocalizations going on all the time, expressing moods of theirs and things they're doing and communications they're making with one another. And, of course, they can get into a cacophony of distress if they sense there's a hawk overhead or other type of predator. So they're very vocal beings. And, of course, the baby chicks, they're peeping all the time, and the mother hen is doing her chook, 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 and you can hear her voice out in the yard. But when hens have been in battery cages for a few months and the chickens are in their incredibly crowded 600-foot-long building, such as we have everywhere down here on the lower eastern shore of Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware, because this is one of the main chicken-producing regions in the country, and it's really what the industry calls the birthplace of the broiler industry, Delaware specifically. But when you walk into a chicken house, either the baby chickens who are going to be slaughtered for meat or the battery-caged hens who are being used to produce commercial eggs for human consumption, you don't hear a sound. These birds who are so lively all day long, with so many vocalizations, voices going on all day long at all ages, all both sexes, and you walk into a chicken house up the road or you walk into a battery cage operation, it's completely silent. They're just... Wow. They're in a condition of learned hopelessness and learned helplessness. And really, I just want to emphasize that what we have done to these birds is a crime. And I'm not talking about whether it's legal. Obviously, every horrible thing we do to other animals, virtually all of it is legal because we decide what laws we're going to pass and enforce as a species. But it is a true crime. It's a crime against them as individuals. It's a crime against who they are through their own evolutionary development and history. It's really a crime against lives and against life. When you strip somebody of every joy that they evolved to have, to experience, and you replace that joy, that happiness, that expressiveness with hopelessness and pain and chronic frustration and all of the horrible things that all of the birds and animals people are eating are, they're ingesting all of that misery, all of that helplessness, and all of that hopelessness. So when I call it a crime that we are committing each and every second against all of these birds and other animals, I'm not exaggerating because there's really no language for the evil that we have brought to their lives and the misery that they endure because of us, because of our species, because of our appetites, because we fancy ourselves as omnivores, that is, the devourer of everything. So we think of that in terms of our, you know, food consumption, but our food consumption attitudes are part of a larger view of ourselves as omnivores who have a right to ransack and appropriate and devastate and do whatever we want with on this planet. And increasingly, we can't wait to just get our claws or our hands on the moon and the other planets. And that's the kind of attitude that has brought so much misery and peril to the planet that we're experiencing through little news clips. If we watch or listen to the news, we get a little glimpse into all the plastics, it's just, you know, we can't.
Everything,
really,
it's unbelievable, Karen. I know.
It's
unbelievable.
It is.
And no matter how much history we read to understand how we got here from there, every step of the way is unbelievable.
And
you've covered so many different topics in your book, and I know we don't have time to talk about all of them, and I want everyone to read it because not only is it scholarly, but it's full of passion. Let's just touch on a few things. So I know a lot of my listeners understand what goes on in industrial farming with birds. We've talked about debeaking. We've talked about how the animals are modified so that their chests, their breasts are enlarged and they can't walk. But you've added some things that I hadn't thought about or remember. I don't know. But there are, I want to say, I'm putting quotes around the word smart. There are smart people out there, scientists, that are trying to come up with ways to solve the problems in industrial farming. And some of the solutions are just beyond horrific than what we're already doing. So you talked about considering blinding the chickens so they don't see where they are, and making featherless chickens so that they're easier to clean, and to make brain dead chickens so that they can just not suffer somehow. This is just sick.
Well, as I say in the book, when, first of all, in the animal advocacy movement, we have, I feel, been harmed as a movement by focusing on the idea of suffering as merely defined as pain. Like, if an animal doesn't literally feel pain, then they're not suffering. But the word suffering means to endure a trauma, an insult to the body, that is, an injury, something that violates the very being of a creature, of a being, an animal. So, for example, I may be suffering from a tumor that's growing in my body right now that I don't even know is there, but I'm suffering from it. I just haven't experienced it yet as a form of pain or other direct distress that I actually feel. But I'm very clear in my book talking about how Peter Singer saying that he would be perfectly satisfied if chickens had their brains knocked out of them, if it would reduce their suffering, that he would be quite satisfied if wingless chickens were bred so they'd have more room in the battery cages. I mean, he actually said that in Slate and elsewhere in an interview in Slate in 2006, Slate magazine. So when you have the so-called father of animal liberation actually suggesting that you mutilate the very being of birds, both surgically and genetically, to reduce suffering, you are in a world of such macabre disconnection from the animals you're talking about. And all of us in this movement have got to make a conscious and concerted effort not to dissociate ourselves from whatever animals we're seeking to advocate for, because a certain type of language or rhetoric begins to develop. And as I talk about in my book, one of the types that is so insulting to animals is where you'll hear people say, oh, well, you know, now we know that pigs are the smartest animal of all the farmed animals, and whales are the smartest animals on the planet. And did you know that crows have been shown to be as smart as a human toddler? Oh, isn't that great? But as I point out in my article on personhood in the book, there is no experiential or neurophysiological comparison or connection between a human toddler or infant or other type of challenged human being, whether developmentally challenged because of age or challenged because of some type of a brain defect or whatever, and a fully competent adult member of other species. A pig and a two-year-old are not synonymous, and we have no business, no right to insult the adult members of other species by comparing them to cognitively challenged human beings and human infants and toddlers. And yet, I still see that kind of reflexively being stated by members of our movement who aren't even examining what they're saying, because they've heard it said, Peter Singer said it, or somebody said it in some organization. So now they adopt that without examination. And what my book seeks to do, among other things, is to get people to examine, that is, members of people in our movement or people who are interested in animal cognition, animal ethology, focusing on avian cognition and avian ethology, to not just have a little stock of concepts that they just keep throwing around out there in the world and without really thinking about what am I really saying here? How does this actually connect to this particular bird or this particular bird behavior? So I am, in my book, I'm taking issue with the whole idea that, okay, you basically cut up a chicken, both surgically and genetically, in order to, quote-unquote, reduce their suffering. In other words, you violate their very being. And then you say, oh, well, if they're not suffering, then, I mean, but again, that completely overlooks the fact that you have a very limited view of what suffering means. And we're not just talking about suffering that comes about in the daily course of, like, a flood or something. We're talking about suffering that is being deliberately imposed, in the case of animal agribusiness, to fit, as these agribusiness scientists like to put it, to fit the biology to the conditions under which the biological being is forced to live. They don't use the word forced, of course, but they are being forced to live. In other words, they like tinkering with the animals. They like tinkering with them. They like doing this and that with their bodies, with their brains and everything. Disenhancing them, for example, that's a term that we hear now, disenhancing the brain of an animal to make them less unhappy in a completely pathogenic, i.e. disease-causing environment, which means full of pathogens, disease-causing microbes, pathogenic in the sense of filth, pathogenic in the sense of no fresh air, no sunshine, no room to move, pathogenic in the sense of total confinement. Everything that we have imposed upon these birds in these conditions have no biological basis in the birds themselves. These are not forms of suffering that make any sense to the nature of these birds. It's completely alien suffering. It has nothing to do with what they evolved to be able to handle in a forest habitat or even in a regular old-fashioned farmyard. It is putting animals, and particularly birds I'm speaking about here, in conditions that are completely inimical and alien to their very being. So the idea is then you basically eviscerate their brains, you eviscerate them, you cut off their appendages, and then you say, I mean, it's so cynical, Karen, because the industry, scientists so-called, and even philosophers, could you believe it, calling themselves philosophers, talk about, yeah, blinding chickens, because then, what they like to say is, well, then they're more calm. Well, they're not more calm, they're just disabled, you know? They're in a cage, and now they can't see, and they don't know, they're helpless.
Going down that path, which is horrible, what makes it not okay? Or what? Maybe it makes it right to at some point do it to humans, where we clone or raise certain humans to do a certain task, but we don't want them to suffer. So we blind them and deprogram their brain. It's like the movie Cloud Atlas. It's another sci-fi thought. But if we do it to one species, we can do it to ourselves.
We could, but I really want to caution people to think too much in those terms. because, first of all, I think we need to look at what we're doing to the these animals themselves. This isn't something we could be doing to them. This is something we are doing to them. And when we talk about raising chickens without feathers, of course, it's already been shown in other studies that when chickens don't have feathers, and particularly if they're living in the filthy compounds in which they're being raised for flesh or for eggs, well, then their skin has no protection. Their skin is even more susceptible to all kinds of blisters and, well, it's a
horrible give them more
situation.
Drugs,
they have
right?
No protection. I mean, they have feathers for protection, to protect their skin. I mean, that's one reason they have feathers. Mm. So, but the thing is, and whether it's our U.S. Department of Agriculture or universities around the world, in Israel is a good example of where these defeathering experiments have been done by a particular experimenter for, like, decades. That's kind of like his signature research project. And he publishes all these articles about his defeathered chickens and how it'll make it better for them. There won't be feathers to deal with in the Middle East when, oh, I don't know. It goes on and on and on. I mean, the animals have no... We at least can raise our voices against what's done to us as human beings. But as far as most people still to this day, and certainly people who are actively engaged in what you want to call exploitation, but even exploitation is too abstract a term to even begin to get close to the details of what we're talking about here. They don't have compassion for these birds. They don't have any constraints upon their behavior. They can do what they want in their laboratories. They can do what they want in their factory farms. And they're doing it. And it's not getting better. It's just getting, if it's possible to get worse, it's getting worse. It's certainly getting more globally expansive. So again, I just caution people from getting too much about, well, if they do it to them, they could do it to us. I think we need to stop thinking about ourselves personally so much and start looking at the world that we have made so sad, so miserable, so, and experiencing such bewildering misery. And what are we going to do about it? Are we going to do anything? What can be done, you know? What can be done?
Exactly. Well, we have just a few minutes left, so that's what I want to focus on. What can be done, and what do you recommend as the most effective forms of activism?
Well, Karen, first of all, I can only speak for the activism that I do, and we have on our website an entire webpage devoted to effective activism. So I urge people who are interested in that to, and of course, to read my book, For the Birds, From Exploitation to Liberation, but also just to let people know we have an excellent, very, very compendious and informative website, which I assume you'll tell people when we stop
Absolutely.
Talking here. But we do, right on our homepage, on the left-hand side, you'll see topics, one of which is effective activism. But part of it has to do with the attitude that we bring to whatever situation we're in where we are actively advocating for the animals we're speaking about on behalf of. And I'll just speak about birds right now. We have to be, as we said earlier, we have to stand up and not be intimidated. We can't start off and say to people we're talking to at a vegetarian festival or if we're leafleting on a busy street or whatever, saying, well, I know a lot of people, or I know most people don't care about chickens, but, you know, we never want to start off telling people that nobody cares. And we understand that you don't care either, and I'm not even sure that I care, you know, is basically what you're saying. I know I sound like a kook for caring about a chicken. Yeah, the rhetoric, what I call the rhetoric of apology, and moving beyond the rhetoric of apology for animal rights. So it's very important that we develop confidence, because without confidence, you can't be an effective activist. If you're not confident in the work that you're doing, if you don't believe in those for whom you have chosen to speak, if you don't believe in your cause, you will never be effective. And part of being effective is learning the subject matter. I can't tell you how many conferences I've spoken at over the years or where I've sat in a session, and there will be all this excellent literature, including ours, and we certainly have a huge array of the very best literature for people to take and read, and they can get it on the internet, have it in print form, and et cetera. But, you know, a person, I or somebody else, will give a talk, and we'll be talking about, you know, how to be an effective activist and so forth, and we'll have all this literature, and then somebody will stand up from the audience and they'll say, yeah, but I understand all that, but what can I do to help animals? I'm like, for heaven's sake. you can't be spoon-fed, okay? If you really want to help animals, you have to take it upon yourself to educate yourself. Fortunately, our movement has grown to the point where the organizations have done the work. We have done and we do the research that we turn into the brochures and the books and the articles and all of the fact sheets.
It's all there. And Dr. Karen Davis, we're out of time, and I can't believe it because I could listen to you all day. You're just an immensely rich and passionate source of information. But I want everyone to read For the Birds, From Exploitation to Liberation, visit United Poultry Concerns, get the information there, and become a better activist because we need everyone out there. And I'm sending you, Karen, lots of love to you and your birds and your team and everyone, and the energy to keep doing what you're doing. Thank you for joining me today.
I'm very grateful for this opportunity to speak with you and to reach out to your listeners. And it's been a real pleasure and an opportunity and a great honor to be on your show. So I'm so happy that we've had this opportunity to promote For the Birds. And that's what we're here for the birds.
Thank you. I hope to dine with you somewhere delicious soon. And everyone, you have a delicious week. We'll be right back.